This is Greening of the Great Lakes, inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, the last time we talked with Dr. Doug Buehler, Director of MSU Ag Bioresearch and Senior Associate Dean for Research in the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources at Michigan State, he had given the President of the United States a mini tour of some of MSU's research projects before President Obama signed the historic Farm Bill. Doug, we don't have a life moment like that to talk about this time, but a lot of good things going on at MSU Ag Bioresearch.
Yeah, it's been a really productive summer so far. Things have come around in terms of the passage of the new Farm Bill and the release of some of the funds. So we're certainly working hard to move forward around our mission of food, environment, and energy. And one of the kind of the misunderstandings, I think, of some people who see college professors, they ask us what we do in our summer because we think we have the summer off. Well, actually, the summer for a lot of our people is the busiest time of the year. So it's a very, very vibrant time for us. A lot of field days going on. We've had great weather, great crowds at our field days, and there seems to be a lot of interest in some of the newer things that we're doing around food systems and some of the environmental issues. And so we're pretty excited right now, and we're really looking forward to another good year coming up.
Well, as you know, Doug, Russ and I had a great day up at Clarksville, one of your research facilities, talking to a number of your great researchers about some of the fruit tree stuff that they've been doing that has direct impact on consumers.
Yeah, well, the Clarksville is a very interesting story, and to me it's a little bit of an embodiment of being able now to come out of our very tough economic times. We had to do a lot of cutting, and we actually, to be honest, considered shutting down that facility because of budget reasons a couple years ago. We made the decision not to do that, and we've now been reinvesting and actually intensifying what we're doing there. And so this is hopefully going to be the beginning of a lot of really good work coming out of Clarksville, and I really want to really appreciate the hard work that the faculty and the staff and folks have done to really get that station back on track. And the work that they're doing out there with the protected environments for high quality cherries and apricots and other valuable fruit, I can tell your listeners that if they ever taste those cherries or some of the other fruit that come out of there, they'll have a hard time eating the things that they're buying that are shipped in from the other end of the country.
Doug, before we get into some other things that MSU Ag Bio is doing and that you personally are doing, regular listeners to this program are familiar with a lot of your researchers and what MSU Ag Bio Research does, but a little overview for those listeners who may not be familiar.
Yeah, the major role of MSU Ag Bio Research is we're really the center of food and natural resources research at Michigan State University. We're a kind of a research institute that's embedded within the university, and we have the opportunity to take advantage of the resources of the entire university to really meet our mission of producing healthy food, protecting the environment, and the things that are all built around that. And it's really a somewhat of a unique situation because when we need additional help from engineers or from people in the natural sciences, social sciences, whatever, we have the opportunity to bring those people in to help us address our mission. And so we're not only agriculture and natural resources is the core of what we do, but it really spans almost the entire campus.
Yeah, you have researchers that you fund and support that are across a number of different colleges at Michigan State University, from communications to engineering to natural science.
Yeah, and don't forget vet med and right. Others as well. So yeah,
we can't forget vet med.
Never forget vet med, yeah.
Doug, on a personal note, congratulations to you. You've just been appointed to a new foundation for food and agricultural research, and you're the only person from Michigan that's on that foundation board. Tell us about it.
Well, it's really in early stages. We just had our first conference call last week. Former Secretary of Agriculture Dan Glickman, who's also on the board, was chosen to be the founding chair of the board of directors. We'll be moving forward in the coming months to develop bylaws and funding guidelines and so on. So it's certainly very early in the process, but I would say it's a great honor to be on a panel like that. It's a group of 15 people from across the country, and I'm really looking forward not only to being part of developing the program and delivering the research, but I'm really looking forward to have opportunity to interact with some of the people that are on that board because there's some very familiar names, both in science and politics, on there.
And given this is a foundation, I take it that this board will make some determinations based on what this foundation is going to fund with respect to research.
Yeah, that's where we'll be moving in the coming months. Really, the organization just needs to be created so that the funding that was committed in the Farm Bill can be turned over to the foundation, and then we'll be working on that. One of the goals of the foundation is that all of the money that's expended will need to be matched by money from other sources. And so we'll be working through that. The idea is, I think, is really to use these dollars as a catalyst to bring private sector and other money to help address the issues. So one of the things that we'll be looking at is that the goal is not for this to be to duplicate other programs that already exist. So I think our trick is going to be to figure out kind of where are those sweet spots where we can use this money to connect to private industry, to other organizations, to bring additional resources to help us meet the high priority problems and some of the more complex problems that are facing agriculture and food.
And to have a voice from the great state of Michigan and from Michigan State University certainly can't hurt as we move forward with some research initiatives. Let's get into a couple of issues that I know MSU Ag BioResearch is involved in. These are major issues that affect not only the ecosystems but consumers directly. Talk a little bit about the bee issue and alternative pollinators. We've got a big problem, don't we?
Yeah, this is a really a major issue for Michigan, for, well, really the whole country for a number of levels. One is simply because, obviously, honey and that industry is impacted. But I think the thing that really comes to strike us here is that the importance of bees and other pollinators in producing our important crops, particularly the specialty crops. And so there have been a number of things happening over the recent years that we still don't understand very fully that have caused some very significant declines in the pollinators. And so we've been fortunate here at MSU that we've started working on some of this work, doing some of this work back probably 8-9 years ago already, looking at alternative bee species, different types of plants that we can plant around orchards and so on. We've got a longstanding commitment to areas in bee health and things like that. And so we've been, I think, out front of a lot of other institutions, and we've been very fortunate because of that, because now that there's been some opportunities to develop some larger projects, having done that preliminary research positioned us very well. And we have a lot of people that are involved with this, but I do need to give special recognition to Rufus Isaacs, who's really been the lead person on this, not only from the science, but has done a lot of work in bringing together colleagues from across the country, and has led a very significant project. And this involves colleagues from all over the country, ecologists, plant scientists, entomologists. This, to me, is really an example of the type of science that we need to do to address these big issues, and really a hallmark of Michigan State University and our ability to work across lines and develop projects that can attack these complex problems in a multidisciplinary way.
On this one, if we have to go to something, the solution is alternative species, and I know that you're not an entomologist, but how long might it take to develop an alternative species of honeybee?
Well, I from some of the things that I see, I think it's more to determine what are the right plant species, you know, what are the adaptability of some of these other bee species. And I think it's something that will be done in a relatively short period of time, but it just is going to take a ramping up of some capacity. And really, again, the first thing is we need to understand what's happening to the bees so that we don't repeat the problem. And so I think it's a complex thing. Like I said, it has things to do with landscape, with plant species. There are all sorts of things that we can do. And so I think we really need to look at an integrated approach to this if we're going to have longer-term solutions to it.
And talk about research that has a direct impact on consumers. We don't have pollinators, and we don't have fruit. There are a lot of things that we as consumers don't have. Reminds me, Doug, of the recent issues we had in Toledo with the drinking water, and the flooding in Detroit, massive flooding. I mean, these are examples, and I know you do a lot in the whole water quality area, examples of where your research and your research solutions have an immediate impact on citizens, people of Michigan.
Yeah, I mean these are great challenges, and you know, one of the things that we're seeing with the increased frequency of very intense rainfall events, some of the solutions that we've developed over time that were quite effective You know, it's more difficult to stand up against these extreme rainfall events and other types of things. And so some of these, you know, we need to understand what's going on here, because I don't know all of what's going on. I don't think anybody does. But this whole thing with Lake Erie, you know, in addition to the algal blooms and the more the traditional issues of the nutrient issues, there also seems to be some changes in the algal populations in the lake that are creating the toxins and some of those types of things. And so that brings in a whole nother piece of the puzzle in terms of the aquatic ecology, what's going on in the water. Maybe invasive species are playing a role in there. So, again, a very, very complicated situation. And then when you overlay the issues of the changing weather patterns, it all becomes very complicated. And as we can see, we can have some very serious problems very quickly.
In some of the press accounts on the Detroit situation, they talked about a 350-year weather event. You know, we're hearing this a lot across the country. Grand Rapids had a 200-year weather event. And at some point, people who deny climate change are going to wake up, aren't they? I mean, geez, how many of these do you have to have?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's obviously a very interesting question. And I think one way to look at it, and I think it's, to me, it's a meaningful way to look at it, is that to me it's very clear that our weather patterns are changing. So we need to respond to that. We can argue whether it's climate change or what's causing it, but the reality is that it's become very, very clear that the weather is changing and these patterns are changing. We need to deal with that, and particularly from the agriculture and natural resource standpoint, we really have to stay on top of that, and we're in the process of getting connected into some of the new initiatives, the USDA Climate Hub was created out at Iowa State University with USDA support. Some of those folks will be in Michigan this fall to work on some of the specialty crops issues. And, you know, when we think about climate change in Michigan's agriculture, all we need to do is think about 2 years ago when the cherry, apple, peach, and other tree fruit grapes as well were devastated by atypical weather events. And when we look at those perennial crops, they are particularly vulnerable to relatively minor changes in weather. So Michigan has a lot at stake in terms of understanding this, in terms of, again, the uniqueness of our agriculture and the diversity of the agriculture.
My guest is Doug Buehler. He's the director of MSU Ag Bioresearch. He's also senior associate dean for research in the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources. Doug, you guys do a regular magazine called Futures. It's an excellent magazine. This latest issue is addressing a major problem, not only in the United States, but worldwide, antibiotic resistance. Tell us a little bit about the issue and some of the things, the issues that are underscored.
Yeah, well, this is another one that, I mean, again, one of these really complex, far-reaching issues that we're facing at this point in time. This is another issue that you look, that it cuts everything from human health to animal health, to animal production, even to some of the plant issues where antibiotics are used for disease management in some of our major crops. And so, you know, we're using a lot of these materials. There are just the basic ecological processes that take place that cause populations to shift. The resistant strains are there and can reproduce and increase over time. And so I think really understanding this and understanding how we're using these materials, how they behave in the environment, where are they needed, where can we cut down, and so on, are going to be very, very critical, because all of these things are going to link together. And, you know, we're seeing the increasing instances of some of these organisms that are, you know, in hospitals and other places that we just can't deal with. And this is really serious business that I think is really going to take some connections of the medical community, the agricultural community, the ecological community to really understand the whole range of issues that are involved here.
Well, your issue couldn't be more timely. As you know, the Center for Disease Control came out with a major study. I mean, it really put this issue up front and center. I mean, some people are even talking about a post-antibiotic era. That's a little frightening on the surface, but maybe it's an opportunity. But I understand that part of the problem is that a lot of antibiotics and new antibiotics haven't been developed in recent years by some of the drug companies for one reason or another.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's another interesting angle of this. I think part of it is that, you know, it's very, very costly to do this type of research. There's a lot of risk involved. And, you know, the whole areas, and this extends beyond antibiotic resistance. We see some of this as well in some of the in the insecticide world, the herbicide world, things like that, where There aren't a lot of new products coming behind that can respond to the changes. And that's something that I think is a little bit, certainly an issue that we need to look at. You know, we have higher standards, and very rightfully so, for registering these products, so it's more costly. We have environmental concerns. We have issues of, you know, impact of non-target organisms. So it's very, very complicated. And again, how we link all these things together and understand how the animal system connects to the human system, connects to what's going on in the environment. Do these compounds break down? How are they coming through? Even things like sewer systems and things like that are all things that are on the research agenda and need to be addressed.
Well, again, for a most informative discussion of the issues, the research issues surrounding that, Futures Magazine, you can find it by Googling Futures or go to the MSU Ag BioResearch website for Futures. Doug, we've got about a minute left, but I know you want to give a shout-out to your associate director, a longtime friend and ally and colleague who's become the new dean of the College of Vet Med at Michigan State University.
Yes, thanks for the opportunity. I do want to take a moment just to mention the role that John Baker played for almost a decade in various roles in MSU Ag BioResearch, and he and I have worked together for most of that time. Actually, I originally came to work in Ag BioResearch when John came over and asked me to help him when he was acting director a number of years ago. So we're going to miss John, but are very excited about his taking on the new role as dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine, because VetMed is a very key partner for us, and so it's going to be great to have an old friend and a good colleague to work with in that role.
And having had the pleasure of working with John myself back in my MSU days, I would just simply reiterate what you said. He's a class act, and he's made major contributions to not only MSU Ag Bio and the College of Vet Med, but Michigan State University in general.
Well said.
I've been talking with Dr. Doug Buehler. He is the director of MSU Ag BioResearch, a senior associate dean for research in the College of Ag and Natural Resources. Doug, I know we'll have you on a few more times in the upcoming year. We appreciate the support of this program from MSU Ag BioResearch, and it's always a pleasure having you on the program.
Well, it's great to be here, and I look forward to the opportunity, and particularly the opportunity for our scientists to talk about what they do through your program.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment. This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. You know, we live in a time where people just don't join things anymore. So why are so many Spartans joining the MSU Alumni Association? Well, perhaps it's our world-class alumni enrichment team, constantly stretching Spartan minds and supercharging Spartan careers. Or perhaps it's our Spartan pipeline, which connects you to trusted friends wherever your adventures may take you. The MSU Alumni Association is dedicated to adding Spartan value to your Spartan life. Whatever it is that may be keeping you up at night, we can connect you with a fellow Spartan who can help. We truly live in a world where who you know is just as important as what you know. And joining the MSU Alumni Association can help you build the relationships you need for success on the job and in every corner of your Spartan life. That's why more and more Spartans are joining the MSU Alumni Association. Activate your membership right now at alumni.msu.edu.
MSU Ag BioResearch is really centered around leading research and developing scientific discoveries in the areas of food, energy, and environment.
Doug Buehler leads MSU Ag BioResearch.
Our history bases us in Michigan, but we've really expanded that mission to the nation and to the world.
MSU Ag BioResearch has more than 300 scientists representing 7 MSU colleges.
We're very interested in continuing to build international linkages because of the importance of what we do and the global nature of agriculture and the global nature of a lot of the problems that we currently face.
MSU Ag BioResearch is leading research and scientific discoveries in the areas of food, energy, and the environment in Michigan, the nation, and around the world.
The core is that we do research on food, energy, and agriculture. The reality is that those three things are important to everybody every day of their life.
Visit agbioresearch.msu.edu.
Greening of the Great Lakes, inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to Greening of the Great Lakes, old friend and environmental attorney, Solis Michelonis. Solis works in the Bloomfield Hills office of Plunkett Cooney Law Firm. He also writes a regular environment and the law blog for Crane's Detroit Business. Solis, always good to see you.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
There's so much that we can talk about, and we're going to take some time in the next two segments to do that. But let's start with something that's much in the news, and that's the new EPA clean air carbon regulations that are being proposed for across the great land of ours.
That's true. That's the EPA has issued proposed regulations for existing sources of greenhouse gases, just one in the next step of greenhouse gas regulations. And it's causing a big hullabaloo.
Absolutely. I was just reading in one of the farm publications yesterday that farmers are already pushing back on these things, saying, oh, energy costs are going to go up, et cetera. You know, the last time we did renewable energy standards in Michigan, we heard the same arguments. But guess what? Energy costs didn't skyrocket.
Well, I always tell people, whenever there are new environmental regs, you always hear about how the sky is going to fall and it's going to destroy economic growth. And the next time it happens will be the first time it happens. People adjust. There are actually reports out there, economic reports by nonpartisan groups who said that actually it may stimulate economic growth.
Well, it certainly happened. We've read some things here in Michigan, but wind energy and solar energy, for example, even the power companies have been surprised that the price of energy has come down when it's being generated by wind turbines.
Yeah, and that isn't surprising because if you take a look at any sort of technology when it gets first introduced, it's very expensive. Look at LCD TVs, look at cell phones, things like that. When they first came out, they're really expensive. But then eventually they start becoming popular, you start manufacturing more, and then the prices always drop. And that's sort of why people argue that you need incentives early on when you have a new technology, and once it gets a foothold, then prices drop. And sure enough, that's what's happened. And I was reading an article recently, for example, in California, it took 20 years for California to get their first megawatt of solar power. It took 1 year to double that. So that goes to show you what happens with technology.
You know, I recently read it or saw an argument where people said, you know, instead of looking at the roads, you know, as a tax burden, et cetera, why not look at it as an investment in our infrastructure? Same thing could be said for renewable energy. When homeowners, maybe the bills do go up initially a little bit, but aren't we investing in the future of our children and our grandchildren? I mean, look at it that way as opposed to all this talk about more taxes, more regulation.
Well, there's a couple ways of looking at it. One, you know, solar, wind, other types of renewable energies, not only do they reduce the need for other types of energy sources like coal, the minute you start producing less energy from coal, you're also getting rid of mercury in the air, you're getting rid of particulate matters in the air, sulfur dioxide, things like that. So there's other benefits that aren't necessarily quantified all the time. And that's when you take a look at the EPA regs, for example, the new regs we're talking about, there's a very large section that talks about economic impact. And part of the economic impact includes what are the health benefits when we start using less of these other types of energy sources. So they're required by law, I think it was an executive order, to factor in these costs. What is it going to cost? And that includes benefits, not just costs. The other interesting thing about it is that it does generate jobs. There was an article that I read yesterday that talked there are more people in the solar power industry now than are in the coal industry. There are more workers doing solar now than in coal. So eventually this stuff takes hold and things increase in frequency and availability and also in decreases in price, and that always happens.
Let's just come back to what the EPA is exactly proposing. Are they proposing one size fits all for all states, 30% by, 2030? Or is there some flexibility by state in terms of these standards?
The goal is to reduce carbon emissions by 30% compared to 2005 rates. And each state is basically given leeway to figure out how it's going to reach that. Every state's going to have their own target. Some states that have gotten on board early to reduce some of their carbon rates won't have to reduce it as much. Other states have to reduce it more. For Michigan, I think it's something like 31% below current carbon emission rates is what their goal is by 2030. And they can do this in any number of ways, and they have certain pathways they can take. And a combination of these, it would be either making carbon-based energy sources more efficient, replacing them with less carbon-intensive fuels like natural gas, for example, using more carbon-neutral energy sources like renewable energies and nuclear, perhaps, and then finally increase efficiency. In other words, use less energy in your community. And you can use any one of those combinations. There's also the ability to join in with other states and create compacts like REGI out on the East Coast, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. There's a bunch of states that have gotten together and able to reduce carbon rates. And this happened a few years ago. And interestingly, those states are doing very well. Their economic growth is up, and they're saving lots of energy. And that might be a way to go for some states who don't want to go it alone.
My guest is Solis Michalonis, an environmental attorney with Plunkett Cooney Law Firm. Solis, what are the next steps then in the process? Right now, the EPA is proposing this. There has to be public hearings, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there will be lawsuits from some states challenging this, but where does it go from here?
Well, where we are right now is in a public comment period that expires in October. So people who have comments, you can go on EPA's website and actually submit comments. The comments that will get the most play will be ones based on technical, economic aspects. In other words, if you send an email saying, I hate renewable energy or I love renewable energy, that's not going to take anywhere. You got to provide some real arguments. And EPA must respond to each of those comments. EPA next week has a series of public hearings, I think three separate public hearings regarding this. So by October, then EPA will get all the comments, and then they will have to review and address all the comments, and then maybe change the statute. Change the regulations to reflect some of the things that they've learned in the meantime. And ultimately, they'll issue a final rule. I think the goal is within 12 months. So by October 2015, there'll be a final rule. And once the final rule is issued, then the litigation will start. Guaranteed.
If you're a listener and you're not a lawyer, then the message here is comment to the EPA and also keep track of this in terms of both your federal and state legislators.
Absolutely. People have a say. The way the regulations, the way Michigan works and the way the U.S. government works is before regulations get promulgated, there's public notice and comment, and you have a chance to have your say, and the agencies must respond to substantive comments.
We mentioned earlier your blog on Crane's Detroit Business. You recently wrote a blog on an issue that's really was brought home to me last week because I happened to be in North Carolina with my family for a week, and that is the whole issue of the reuse of incinerator byproducts, coal ash and things of that nature that have unfortunately been dumped into some North Carolina rivers. Tell us about that issue.
Well, coal ash is, you know, there's two different types of ash. There's bottom ash and top ash, and it, when you burn coal, you generate a lot of ash. And some of the stuff, and historically, has been reused. A lot of the stuff is just stockpiled and landfilled. What happened in North Carolina, I think it was Duke Power,
yes.
Right. One of their, in a heavy rainstorm, one of their walls that in the landfills breached the landfill and dumped about 80,000 tons of this stuff into a river.
Right.
Michigan is recently looking at a statute which will actually encourage the reuse of these types of things because they're generally inert. A lot of these are inert. And you can use them for a variety of things. You can use them as a component of asphalt or concrete, for example, to replace other types of materials. You can use it as cover for landfills. You can use it in some of the stuff is good to be used for agricultural
fertilizers
and things like that. Probably not coal ash, but things from like wastewater treatment plants, things like that. And so provided that the material meets certain specific requirements in terms of what their constituents. In other words, they can't have a lot of heavy metals and bad stuff. But as long as it passes, you'll be able to use it in Michigan, and there'll be incentives to do so.
It sounds almost like a win-win, because you're looking at cradle to cradle here. I mean, otherwise, what do you do with this stuff?
Well, you can put it in the landfills, and you can have what happened in North Carolina. Right, right. And, you know, I mean, the stuff has... From what I've read, I mean, a lot of this stuff is, in terms of potential contaminants, pretty inert. I mean, you know, I don't know if you've been following with the USS Badger, the coal-fired ferry that goes back and forth.
Absolutely.
And for historically, they've dumped that coal ash into Lake Michigan as they've gone back and forth. Probably not a great thing to do, but at the same time, if it was really filled with a lot of bad contaminants, that practice would have been stopped a long time ago. So a lot of this stuff can be reused safely, and to the extent we can, it's a good thing.
And what do you think are the prospects for this legislation? I mean, we just heard from other guests on this program that nothing gets done in Lansing these days, but this sounds like a no-brainer.
Yeah, I think this will pass.
Yeah. Let's move on. We're talking about agriculture a minute ago, but have some issues with agricultural runoff, nutrient runoff into Lake Erie big time. We got algal blooms back in Lake Erie. The state of Ohio doesn't seem to be in any hurry to deal with the problem. Your comments on that?
Well, the state of Ohio isn't in a hurry because they're pointing the finger at Michigan. Michigan's turning around pointing the fingers at Ohio. You know, back in the day, you and I are old enough to remember the Time magazine, is Lake Erie dead?
Cuyahoga River.
Well, the Cuyahoga River burned because of oil, but whether Lake Erie was going to die because of all the nutrients from dishwashing detergent and clothes detergent. They got rid of phosphates, remember all that sort of stuff. And for a while, Lake Erie came back. Recent reports from the International Joint Commission, the Canadian-U.S. commission that oversees the Great Lakes, are showing a repeat performance. And this time, the culprit apparently are failed septic tanks and agricultural runoff, especially from large animal feedlot operations. And there are very few controls over this. It's pretty much a voluntary program. So the stuff ends up in the lakes and streams, eventually makes its way into the lakes and creates algal blooms, and which in turn kills oxygen.
It's a scenario of a possible dead lake.
Right, and so there are a lot of issues with respect to that, and everybody's looking at hard how to fix that.
I read recently where a group of Ohio producers now has agreed to sit down with EPA and others to take a look at this. I haven't read anything similar from Michigan's perspective, but what kind of legal implications do we have here?
Well, right now in Michigan, sort of has a voluntary program where farms can participate. But it's not. There's no teeth to it. Mm-hmm. So the question is whether there's going to be any teeth to it. I'm doubting it at this point in time. Eventually, you're going to need the political will to do something to say this is an issue and we have to do it. So if we have more and more problems with Lake Erie and maybe the other lakes too, I mean, rivers go all over the place and stuff. Yeah. And since the Great Lakes, the existence of the Great Lakes itself is such a huge financial benefit for the state, eventually people are going to say, well, wait a minute, we got to start making some trade-offs. And there are ways to handle this stuff. I mean, it's not rocket science.
To your knowledge, any environmental groups filed suit in terms of some of these agricultural practices?
Is there
anything in the courts right now?
I have not seen anything. There may be. I haven't read anything about it.
Let's turn to fracking. A lot of folks have that as their least favorite or favorite subject to talk about when it comes to environment. Michigan has proposed some new fracking regulations. There's been some public comment lately on those fracking regulations. Where are we with the fracking regs from the DEQ?
Well, they'll probably be finalized really soon. I mean, they just had some public hearings on that. A lot of criticism. You know, basically what Michigan's fracking regs are going to be pretty tough compared to other states.
Right.
Especially when it comes to water withdrawals and the use of water. One of the main reasons is a lot of the stuff, if you're looking to frack, especially in the northern part of the state, those wells go very, very deep and you need lots
and lots of water.
The horizontal
fracking demands so much more water. Yep.
Right. And Michigan has an obligation actually under the Great Lakes Compact to minimize consumptive uses of water. And there are groundwater requirements in terms of how much water you can use and take out of the system, and especially if you affect surface water and other groundwater, right? So it'll be very interesting to see how this all comes into play. Some of the good things about it, there'll be requirements to sample groundwater in and around these areas where they're fracking to see if there's any impacts to the groundwater, which if I'm a fracking company, I'd like, because everybody, you know, talks about, okay, fracking causes all these problems. So if you have a baseline, which you know what the water like right. is like, then, and then you can compare, then you'll know whether or not there's a problem with that particular well. I mean, fracking's been used all over the state, all over the country for decades. I mean, it's not a new technology. From what I understand,
it's just monitored better in some states than others.
Right. And if you do it right, if you have good qualified companies doing it right, that shouldn't be a problem. And if I'm a company engaging in fracking, I would definitely want to make sure that everybody's following the same rules.
What about this requirement, non-requirement? You don't have to disclose the contents of your fracking fluid until 30 days after the well has been drilled. Why shouldn't they be able or have to disclose that ahead of time?
Well, I think maybe the reason is because I think every well is different, and I don't think they know what they're going to use up until they start getting ready to do the welling, to do the drilling. So I think that's probably the main, I think it's a realization that not every well's using the same systems, the same fracking fluids and things like that. I would definitely want to know ahead of time if I could. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are some states that make it illegal to disclose it.
Yeah, they argue that it's because it's proprietary information, the same thing you just said, and they're competing companies, and they don't want their competitors to know what's in their fracking
right.
fluid.
Right, I think it's North Carolina. I might be wrong, but it's criminal to disclose what's in fracking fluid, believe it or not.
Well, back to North Carolina,
right.
The stories I've heard about the lack of environmental in North Carolina right now is that people are pretty unhappy down there.
And it's very interesting because there are some companies out there that do fracking and stuff like that that openly disclose that stuff.
That's their
So could you put a company in jail for disclosing what they're
right.
I don't know. It's in a state of flux. There's actually a governor's race in Colorado that might hinge on fracking.
On the fracking issue.
Because there's a petition to ban fracking in Colorado.
And one last footnote on fracking. I have read where some companies now are trying to develop fracking fluids that don't have cyanide and other dangerous chemicals. So they're continually working on the chemistry to try and improve their fracking fluids from an environmental standpoint.
And I would say that. I mean, and there's also other issues, too, with fracking that people don't think about. You know, all these, the proppants, the things they use is sand, and there's certain types of sand you can use. Mm-hmm. Well, Minnesota's dealing with this now because they're doing massive amounts of mining for sand there for fracking. And these are, and the fracking sands are located in areas that are very rural, and the people who moved out there didn't want to move out there because of mining. Now they've got these trucks with sand coming through their little quaint little towns and stuff. So, I mean, this is all sorts of
unintended consequences,
right, exactly.
Or positive and negative. You sent me something that was very interesting, Solace, and we'll conclude the interview on that, but apparently the National Hockey League, and this is not necessarily a legal issue, but they've issued a sustainability report. That's pretty interesting. I actually got hooked on reading it and went through most of it. It's kind of amazing what the NHL is doing and their whole position on the environment.
Well, one of the points they make is that part of the game, the thing that bring the players play, is outdoor hockey. And with climate change and warming, there will be less and less of an opportunity for kids to do that. I mean, you know, pond hockey is a huge thing. I mean, I wasn't a hockey player growing up, but I played pond hockey all winter long.
Yeah, my brother and I did as well.
And that's a lot of – and that's, you know, the Canadians, the Americans who play hockey, they see this as part of their legacy, and they're concerned about it. It's a very unique program. I'm very interested in because one, I'm interested in sustainability, and two, I love hockey. It's my favorite sport. So,
that's why you. I'm interested. I may send that along to MSU Athletic Director Mark Hollis, because how cool would it be for a Big Ten university to have a sustainability report come out of their athletic department?
Well, I'm also thinking. I mean, they're building a whole new rink in Detroit. For the Red Wings. Now the question is, and of course it's all conceptual at this point, but it'll be interesting to see how much of this NHL sustainability policy ends up in the development of that particular rink. One of the interesting things about this rink, as I understand it, it's going to be a below-ground rink. So, in other words, the ice will be below ground, which is more efficient in terms of keeping the ice
cold. Almost using geothermal.
Exactly. So, I don't know if that was done for that particular reason. I think it was basically so it wouldn't be a giant footprint on Woodward, you know, like a big behemoth like hanging over Woodward. But that might be a reason. So it'll be interesting to see if the Red Wings sort of adopt that sort of thing. I hope so.
Well, not to get down on our favorite hockey team, but as I was looking through the report, I didn't see the Red Wing logo up next to very many of those initiatives, and it concerned me a little bit.
Yeah, I think this is they're just starting out with this process. I think there'll be I'm sure there are memos from the head office and Gary Bettman to all the owners saying, okay, this is what we want to do, and let's start doing it. And I doubt if the NHL went ahead with this without having the owners on board.
Certainly. And maybe Bettman becomes the Bill Ford of hockey, you know, in terms of his sustainability plan.
Well, he could use some good press.
Yeah, that's for sure. Oh, it's always a pleasure. I've been talking with Solas Michalonis, an environmental attorney at Plunkett Cooney in Bloomfield Hills. He also blogs. You can catch his blog on Crane's Detroit Business and also on the Plunkett Cooney website. Solas, great to have you on the program, and we'll do it again next year.
I always love doing this. Thanks so much.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. How many times have you been wearing your Spartan apparel in an airport? And a voice in the crowd shouts, "Go green!" Well, that's happened to me in Beijing, Osaka, Kuala Lumpur, and Mumbai, and even in unlikely places like Ann Arbor and Columbus. There's a special bond we Spartans share, and that's at the foundation of everything we do at the MSU Alumni Association. As the world's largest organization of Spartans helping Spartans, MSUAA truly is your personal network for life. From the moment you join, you've added thousands of fellow Spartans to your personal network. People who will pick up the phone and lend a hand just because you share Michigan State in common. That's the ethic that makes Spartans leaders, lifesavers, and world changers. And that's exactly what you'll find when you become an active member of the MSU Alumni Association. If you share this Spartan spirit, join us at alumni.msu.edu.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes, inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, we've discussed climate change many times over the years on this program, but frankly, we've tended to focus on the impact of global warming and climate change on America. However, there are parts of the world where the ramifications are perhaps far more immediate and even more dire. Our next guest has spent a number of years in East and Southern Africa researching the causes and consequences of environmental change, particularly on agricultural systems. She is Jennifer Olson, Dr. Jennifer Olson, Associate Professor in the College of Communication Arts and Sciences at Michigan State University. Jennifer, a very warm welcome to the program, no pun intended.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Our listeners, you've done a lot of work in Africa. Give our listeners a snapshot of the research that you've done and the relationship to the issues of climate change and agriculture.
Okay, well, we started out looking at broader environmental changes that are occurring and the causes and consequences of those changes. So, for example, we looked at deforestation and other land use changes and how that was affecting the ecosystem in agriculture. We also looked at biodiversity changes and the causes and consequences of that for farmers and for the ecosystem itself. But in the last about 12 or 14 years, climate change became the dominant issue And the reason why we started being interested in climate change was because the farmers and the herders were complaining about it. And farmers and herders often complain about the weather. That's nothing new.
That's universal, isn't it?
That's universal, and they have good reason to complain. But this seemed new and different. And so we really started, we were one of the first groups of people who really started looking at climate change impacts on agricultural systems and pastoral systems in Africa.
And what do you, with respect to climate change over there, I mean, what do your data show with respect to what's actually going on as far as climate is concerned? Are things getting, it's sub-Saharan Africa, so it's already a pretty warm ecosystem.
That's right, and that's why it's so serious, and that's why the impacts are happening there faster than perhaps they're happening here in Michigan. So what's already happening and what's documented, you know, shows up in the statistics and everything is, first of all, a really significant increase in temperatures already by about 3 or 4 or 5 degrees Fahrenheit. Wow. And that, of course, has big impacts on water demand of plants and water stress of plants and also higher evaporation. So the lakes and the rivers don't have as much water as they used to. The streams that used to run year-round are now running only during the rainy season. And then the other big change that's already happened is changes in the rainy seasons. And so, for example, it's in some places the amount of rainfall is changing, either more or less. But the big change that's happened is that rain is much more variable. So farmers can't depend anymore on when the rainy season is going to start, so they don't know when to plant. They don't know when the rainy season is going to end, so they don't know what crops to plant, because each year and each season it's different. So that's a big problem for farmers. And then another big problem is that for farmers and herders, the rainy seasons seem to be getting shorter. So this means that, of course, the dry seasons are longer, and so the natural grass and other vegetation that herders depend on is drying out faster and there's not as much of it. And it also means that farmers just can't plant the same crops that they used to. For example, the corn, the long duration corn that they used to plant, they might not work anymore. So they're having to plant shorter duration corn and other plants.
So your role and your colleagues, and I know that you're involved in several multidisciplinary projects, but what is it when you interface with the herders and with the farmers? I mean, what types of interactions are you having?
We're having different types of interactions. So luckily, we've been able to go back to the same communities where we've been working for many, many years, which is terrific for us because
you have trust.
We have trust, exactly. And also, we have an idea about what used to be the case and have a sense of what they're saying, you know, and how important it is. So basically, it's talking to people. So we do formal questionnaires and formal surveys, and we do group interviews where we get together, for example, a group of women and a group of men and divide them up by farmers and herders or other things and have a brainstorming or a discussion about impacts of climate change and then how they're responding to climate change, so how they're trying to both change their agricultural system to respond to the changes, and what else they're doing, because now they just can't depend on what they used to be able to depend on. So they're having to do non-agricultural activities much more than they used to have to.
My guest is Dr. Jennifer Olson. She's an associate professor in the College of Communication Arts and Sciences at Michigan State University. Jennifer, you've done a lot of development work, as I mentioned earlier. When you're working with locals like this, I mean, there was a time when development was pretty top-down back in the early days, the 40s and 50s. The whole paradigm has changed. I mean, maybe you can speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, right. So now the big emphasis is on what's called participatory development. And the whole ethos of participatory development is that rather than, as you said, top down and us coming in with solutions that we've developed from elsewhere and you know, expecting it to be the solution for farmers and herders, is that the researchers and extension people and other people are working with the farmers and with the herders to identify the problems and see what would be possible and then to develop solutions with them. So, for example, to test different types of agricultural technologies or irrigation technologies or other things with the farmers to see what works and why. And that's interesting because things that we didn't really realize before, for example, the big difference between men and women and how they farm becomes apparent when you do that, that you know, that otherwise was invisible and didn't happen.
You know, it occurs to me, Jennifer, you're talking about countries like Tanzania and Kenya and Uganda, et cetera. These folks in these countries are not emitting a whole lot of fossil fuels into the environment, but it seems like they're suffering inordinately from what some of the more developed industrialized countries, some of the abuses that, frankly, countries like the United States are causing.
That's right. That's right. And it's heartbreaking because they're seeing the impacts, they're feeling the impacts of climate change very immediately. They don't have very much margin of safety at all. They're mostly small family farms. There's no crop insurance or other insurance. They have very little credit. And so if there's a failed harvest, then it's of immediate importance to them. And the other heartbreaking thing about it is that the farmers don't realize that it's not their fault. They tend to blame themselves. They say that, you know, the climate is changing because they cut down too many trees or that there's too many people.
They don't have a sense of the macro.
No, they don't. They don't see the, you know, they this whole idea about greenhouse gases is very well known in the academic community and governments. But farmers themselves tend to blame deforestation and cutting down of trees. And so one response that they're doing, interestingly, is actually planting more trees, which will help the microclimate. But right. it really won't help these big changes in the rainy seasons and things like that.
And all the years you spent over in Africa working with folks over there, what are you most hopeful and optimistic about?
How rapid things are changing and how rapid things are improving. It is just incredible. Farmers are trying all different kinds of things and adopting all different kinds of things. And also the governments have gotten on to not just learning about the impacts of climate change, but implementing new projects and programs to respond to it much more quickly than, for example, us here in the U.S. So things are changing very fast. The economies in most of the countries is growing very fast. So there's a lot of potential for development in the right direction and improvements in the right direction.
I've been talking with Dr. Jennifer Olson. She's an associate professor in the College of Communication Arts and Sciences at Michigan State University. She's also done extensive research on climate change and its impacts on agriculture in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. Jennifer, thanks so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, please click on the local tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.